Greetings and welcome to The Other Animals, the show that, when it comes to animals, is happy to admit it doesn't know what it doesn't know. We are a proud member of the iWAR Podcast Network. I am your host, Laurent Levy, and I'm joined, as always, by Tom Picard of All Pets House Calls, who joins us remotely today as he continues his convalescence. How you doing, Tom?
Oh, pretty good. Just going to take it a little easy.
There you go.
Step forward, little step rest.
You got to do what you got to do. There you go. So today's going to be a bit off script, as I don't have the singular theme we usually do. But I think that's going to be okay, because now you don't know exactly what's coming. But I'll give you a hint in that it includes dogs again. I mention that because I notice on the podcast metrics that when I have dogs in the topic description, I get lots and lots of downloads. So dogs, dogs, dogs. We're going to get a lot of dogs. Anyway, that's it. Autumn is upon us again. And with that is the return of football season. So truth be told, I confess I'm much more of a baseball fan than a football fan. But growing up in my college town, I was unfortunately infected for life with an addiction for my Mountaineers. So when I was watching them beat NC State last weekend, a curious commercial, which I guess is a football-type commercial, came on that I have since learned has been around since the summer, but it was my first encounter with it. It's the one from Boston Market, and it starts with a visual image of dozens of dead chickens on a slowly turning rotisserie. But of course, since they're on the rotisserie, they're meant to look somehow delicious. And the first part of the commercial, I really wasn't giving it too much attention. For now, making dead animals look delicious remains normalized in our culture, and you just kind of got to roll with that a little bit. However, as the commercial wore on, Boston Market, which I remember, by the way, as being named Boston Chicken once upon a time, it became apparent that the ad was still trying to emphasize its expanded offering of dead cow options in the form of prime rib, rack of ribs, meatloaf, that kind of thing. So here's where it got weird. As the off-camera hands slice into that presumably delectable dead flesh while swinging background music plays, the image is intentionally distorted, like they do to mask someone who doesn't want to be recognized, or more aptly, what they do to mask a body part that is deemed pornographic or offensive. Then the moment of truth, the caption that reads, "Content may not be suitable for all audiences, namely vegetarians." Wait, what? Was that meant to demean vegetarians? Was it meant to be funny? Was it meant to stir up controversy, get people talking about it? Well, I did some old-fashioned internet sleuthing to see what the response among animal folks had been to the ad, and curiously, it seemed to achieve none of the above. In fact, it seems I may be giving it more airtime here than it's received anywhere else. But then I had this funny memory of being in Mexico City some years ago, and in my hotel room, having the otherworldly experience of watching Speedy Gonzalez cartoons with Spanish subtitles. Now, for anyone who doesn't know, Speedy Gonzalez is, by today's standards, most likely racist in that Speedy is a mouse who wears a sombrero, is partial to mariachi music, and speaks heavily accented Spanglish. It's a clumsy comparison, I admit it. But to add the Spanish subtitles, it seemed to me, is equivalent to promoting meat eating by distorting an image of cutting into the dead flesh under the guise of not being suitable to watch. It isn't suitable to watch. Go to any Mercy for Animals undercover video and see what goes on in a slaughterhouse, then make up your own mind whether or not it's suitable to watch. But by distorting an image of that, Boston Market, of course, hopes to trivialize the process of killing the animal, but don't they inadvertently just call attention to it? I just wonder if they're not accidentally planting a seed that calls out the grossness of just how all that bovine flesh comes to be on all those plates. We'll just have to wait and see. But for now, it's time for Animals in the News. All right, that trumpet, the elephant trumpet blast is telling, because unfortunately our first story today is the sad outcome of the case of Beulah, one of the elephants. Our earlier guest, attorney Stephen Wise, and his organization, the Non-Human Rights Project, was working to get released from her roadside zoo captivity. You may remember Stephen Weiss. It was really, if you're looking on the podcast, go back to that episode. He was an amazing guest. The Hartford Courant reported on Wednesday that she died while still in captivity. Beulah, was a 54-year-old Asian elephant, had been a longtime attraction at the Big E Annual Fair in West Springfield. Spokesman for the Eastern States Exposition confirmed. Her death was reported to the USDA's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service, but the cause of death is unknown, which is curious in its own right. Beulah was owned by the Goshen-based Comerford Zoo and was one of three elephant clients represented, and the article puts clients in quotes, represented by Stevens' group, the Non-Human Rights Project. And they sued unsuccessfully in 2017 in state court to establish that the elephants were legal persons and demand that they must be released to a sanctuary. This is the official statement from Stevens' group, the Non-Human Rights Project. Quote, it is with deep sorrow and outrage that we have learned our elephant client Beulah has died after collapsing multiple times at the Big E Fair in West Springfield. Because of businesses like the Comerford Zoo and the Big E, she never had a chance to live. Under threat of bull hook, the Comerford Zoo stole from Beulah her freedom and anything resembling a natural existence for an elephant, end quote. The Non-Human Rights Project argued Beulah, Karen, and Minnie, those are the three that they're representing, have senses of selves and are entitled to the rights any human person would have against illegal detention. The group insisted that the elephants also are entitled to habeas corpus, a common law concept used since the era of American slavery to free people from illegal detention. Courts have repeatedly struck down the group's assertion, however, and most recently the one that I intended, the hearing that I watched Stephen argue, and in fact just a couple weeks ago the decision came back on that. It was a 3-0 decision that he did not win that appeal. The Non-Human Rights Project has appealed that decision and asked the entire appellate court to reconsider. Quote, our fight to secure recognition of our elephants' clients' right to liberty and their release to sanctuary will continue in Beulah's name and in the names of all the elephants before her who have found freedom only in death, Wise said. We will announce next week further actions we are taking, including in the Connecticut courts, and we'll keep you up to date on that. This case is a long way to go. Next story, we go from Connecticut out to Texas. This one's really weird. Texas hounds chased down rhino poachers in South Africa. This came from National Geographic on Wednesday. And National Geographic, it's the curious case of a Texas part-time rancher, cop, and businessman. His name's Joe Brayman, and he was being retained by Kruger National Park in South Africa to chase armed rhino poachers. Specifically, the dogs are his coonhounds. Since then, according to authorities, his hounds have helped law enforcement teams in the greater Kruger region catch an unprecedented 145 poachers and confiscate 53 guns. That's interesting. Boosting the overall rate of successful arrests and providing a new strategy to fight poaching in Africa. And just for a little bit of background here, about some 8,000 rhinos whose horns are smuggled to Asia for unfounded medicinal uses were poached in South Africa from 2008 to 2018, with more than half killed in Kruger, the country's signature national park, and the surrounding private reserves. There are some 20,000 white rhinos and just over 5,000 critically endangered black rhinos in the wild across Africa. South Africa is home to about 80% of the world's last remaining rhinos. Here, however, is when the story gets interesting from our perspective here on this show. You see, Brayman's coonhounds get their name from, well, I'm going to let Brayman describe it himself. This is his quote. I'll try not to do a Texas accent, but the way it's written, it has all the Texasisms. I grew up running pack hounds with my father, he says. We would chase bobcats and raccoons, training 15 or 18 dogs at a time to follow the scent of animals. Their dogs, broadly called American coonhounds because of their ability to track down raccoons, came in various breeds, black and tan, blue tick, red tick. After becoming a deputy game warden for Texas Parks and Wildlife, Brayman joined the Houston Police Academy in 2001 and has been working for the sheriff's office in Refugio and Victoria counties ever since. He also has a master chef degree from culinary school and says he takes his interest to the extreme. Everything I do it to the fullest of my capability. I push myself to be the best. Deploying one sentient animal to protect another sentient animal by training it to track and kill yet another sentient animal. And just to clarify what that training involves, here's what the deal is. Teaching a hound to bite a person and hold them at bay is, quote, one of the hardest things in the world, Brayman says. You have to separate new puppies from their mother for short periods and withhold food, which makes them mad at you. And you let them know it's okay to bite and bark, quote. In the field, the dogs learn to follow an individual human scent trail and then to nip and bite while on the run. Quote, we teach them to stay with that person, and if they don't, they get their behind kicked. End quote. Brayman says that after a few weeks in South Africa, he grew frustrated with the slow progress they were making with the local dogs. Quote, they are pushing water up a hill, he says. Their hearts were in the right spot, but they just don't do things the way we do in Texas. So one day during training, this gentleman, Van Straten, who is the park's lead trainer of its own dogs, showed Brayman a video of a paralyzed rhino whose horn had been axed off that day by poachers. He was aspirating on his own blood, Brayman remembers. I don't think I've ever seen anything as horrific. He says he watched the video over and over again, and every time he became more angry. I believe in reaction, he says. You do something, that means I'm going to do something twice as bad to get you back. Some of these people are recklessly killing two or three rhino a night. That's a war. And all is fair in war. And there you go. Human-animal interaction in all its glory. Do the ends justify the means? Just to be clear, I did reach out to Mr. Brayman to join us on the show. He has thus far not responded. The invitation remains open. I would love to discuss this in great detail with him. One more quick story. I won't go into the details. Maybe do some more details on a later show. This is from NPR. Just reporting a loss. This came out yesterday. North America has lost 3 billion birds. Go check that article out. So three billion birds, or something, or along the lines of 30%. It's a story worth looking at. It's just a population loss. Finally, this is our last recall story. You may remember the New York Times op-ed article I introduced a few weeks ago by Alexandra Horowitz, in which she challenges the policy of spaying and neutering our dogs and cats. And just to refresh your memory, she wrote, to solve the problem of our unwillingness to keep track of our dogs, we do not address our unwillingness. To address the overpopulation of unwanted dogs, we do not address the overpopulation. Instead, we non sequitur. We take brand new dogs and introduce them into our homes by first putting them through a surgery at 6, 4, or even 3 months of age. The professed solution in the United States is to spay or neuter all the new ones. For me, simply to bring up the topic of desexing for discussion will be, in the eyes of some, impermissible. So sacred is the policy, and so heartfelt and good-hearted is the intent behind it. So, as promised, when we return, we will be speaking live with the author, Alexandra Horowitz, herself, to discuss this in more detail. We will be right back.
Your pets don't like getting in cages and cars to go to the vet any more than you like sitting in a waiting room. Why not remove the stress for both of you? Have all pets house calls with me, Dr. Tom Picard, come take care of your pets from the comfort of their own couch. We do checkups and exams for illnesses, problems, shots, and much more. Monday through Saturday appointments throughout far and wide areas of Philadelphia and surrounding suburbs. Please call us at 215-843-1780, or please feel free to submit questions so I can answer them on the air for you. Contact us by email at allpetshousecalls@comcast.net or visit our website at allpetshousecallsvet.com.
All right, welcome back to The Other Animals on WWDB. Alexandra Horowitz is keen on the mind of the dog. She has long been interested in understanding the umwelt of another animal, and her research and writing is aimed to answer the question of what it is like to be a dog. She's also written about the joys of paying attention to the ordinary in On Looking, the pleasures of footnotes and the veracity of animal characters in children's books for the New York Times, and Working Dogs and Show Dogs for the New Yorker. She is a professor at Barnard College, Columbia University, where she teaches seminars in canine cognition, creative nonfiction writing, and audio storytelling. As senior research fellow, she heads the dog cognition lab at Barnard. She lives with Finnegan, Canis familiaris, Upton, Canis familiaris, Edsel, Felis, Catus, and two Homo sapiens. And she will also be appearing in person here in Philadelphia at the Wagner Free Institute of Science next Thursday, the 26th, at 6 o'clock. And as a bonus, that appearance will be with James Serpell, who was also on our show just a few weeks ago. They will be discussing James' book, Our Dogs, Ourselves. Additional details at WagnerFreeInstitute.org. Alexander, welcome to the program.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Okay. So first of all, before we get to the article, I have to admit, we're about a half year or so into the program, and that word, Umwelt, I can't believe I've come this far and I've not had the opportunity to talk about Umwelt. We had it when I was doing my anthropology study. That word was all over the place, and it's so cool that you brought it up in your intro for the first. Why don't you tell us what Umwelt really means and why it's so important for us?
Right. You know, I learned about this idea of Umwelt from Jakob von Uexkull, who's a German biologist over 100 years ago, who appropriated this German word, which really just means worldview in German, or surroundings, right? To talk about the perspective of each animal, each species, and each individual animal, mm-hmm. thinking about things from their point of view, what's relevant in their world, what can they perceive mm-hmm. at all, and what things are important for them to know about. So I think it was an important word to bring back and introduce in the context of trying to think about the mind of dogs.
I know the example they always use, and you kind of reference it in your article. And God, they made us read this all the time with the Thomas Neufeld, What It's Like to Be a Bat.
Thomas Nagel.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Almost every class we had to read that article. I have to admit, after 10 times, I really had problems with it. It's actually kind of a difficult read, but that's the concept, right? It's just, you know, you're trying to get into the mind, and ultimately, I think the conclusion is we never can quite do it, right?
Yeah, philosophically, Nagel thought he was responding to the fact, by the way, that it had just been discovered that bats echolocate, mm-hmm. By Donald Griffin and others at Rockefeller, which was mind-boggling for people, right? We hadn't seen this kind of perceptual ability by any animal, and people thought bats were blind. You know, they were just like, I don't know, making their way around accidentally. And so it got people interested in what it might be like to be an echolocator, you know, like seeing the world through sending out sounds and hearing them. And Nagel really thought you kind of can't ever know, for the reason that you can't literally get in the head of someone else,
right?
Other person or other species. But I don't think that should stop us. I mean, we certainly can take what I call an imaginative leap into the mind mm-hmm. of another animal, just as we do into the mind of other people by kind of just knowing a lot about them, and not just how their cognition and perception works, but their history.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So that leads us getting into the mind, perhaps, of the dog. And so this article, first of all, you upended Bob Barker. Now, how could you do such a thing? this is you treaded on cigarettes. So why don't, just for people who may not have read the article, describe your position on this. That we've heard so much, I mean, I certainly have, that responsible pet ownership, spay neuter. What's wrong with that?
Yeah. So I should say this is an excerpt that was from Our Dogs, Ourselves, and the Times was interested in it precisely because it presents an opinion which goes against the kind of accepted policies. And I too grew up with Bob Barker, with everyone responsible spays or neuters their animals. I've lived with spayed and neutered animals my entire life. You know, a half century. That's the way the world kind of was. But as with studying dogs, I'm taking something familiar and known and kind of accepted and concluded and just examining it again. And just as the science of dogs has shown us sort of more richness to their life than we might have imagined, there's more complexity to this issue than I knew about than most people I talk to know about. And it has to do with all elements of the issue. You know, for one, it was set out intentionally and possibly very appropriately at the time to try to help solve this catastrophe of overpopulation of dogs and cats, where we were euthanizing many millions. It's unsure what the figure was, but maybe 15, maybe 20 million animals a year
unwanted. And that's just in the United States, right?
It's just in the United States, okay. Right? So that's in the 70s. Mandatory spay-neuter policies started then, or some spay-neuter, and then it's become now the policy of most shelters and humane societies, and in even some areas, it's in the laws. And since then, there are many, many fewer euthanized dogs and cats every year, just a couple million. So people say, listen, if we don't spay-neuter, then we're going to revert to that past state. And unfortunately, it's not entirely clear that it is just spay-neuter or even spay-neuter at all that's led to that great decline. You know, for one thing, there are lots of other changes in pet ownership since 1970 that are responsible for perhaps fewer animals. Intake at shelters have gone way down. Just how we deal with pets, you know, as a child, we let our dog out at night to run.
Right.
If he were not neutered, that's a time that you're going to create new puppies. So now we don't leave our dogs outside. We don't let them run. We keep them inside.
Okay.
So there's much less opportunity, you know, on the whole.
Right.
There are better containment methods, meaning, you know, we can find our dog, we microchip our animals. And so if they're lost, it's easier to find them. Previously, if they were lost, then picked up by a pound, they were one of the dogs who would, if not found by their people, would have to be euthanized. The other way of looking, and spay-neuter was a part of this, you know, contributed to this decline, but we can't tell how much it was responsible.
Right.
The other way of looking at it is to look at countries, you know, like Norway or Sweden, where until recently in Norway it was illegal to spay or neuter, but they don't have a giant spay neuter.
It was illegal to spay?
Or a stray population. It was illegal to spay or neuter.
Really?
Your dog, yes.
Under what grounds? Why would they have done that?
Some of these countries are much more concerned with prioritizing the dignity, the integrity of the animal. So they have an entirely different relationship with dogs. You know, Switzerland has in their laws, they have an Animal Protection Act, which even invokes the dignity of the animal, where you're not allowed to do surgeries on the animal if they are unnecessary for that animal. And what, if you look at it that way, just for a second, I was really interested in this.
Yeah.
It's not for the animal that we're doing the spay-neuter. It's for us.
It's for us, convenience.
It's for us because it's for our convenience.
Yeah.
And it's also to try to solve a problem that that animal didn't have anything to do with. The problem is because of our society's way of treating animals. We own animals. I think that's really what it comes down to in some extent. They're personal property, and we're allowed to buy, sell, trade, abandon, breed, whatever, them. And as long as we're doing that, you can't spay-neuter this problem out of existence. That's one side of it. Another side is all this interesting research that's come out from Ben Hart and Lynette Hart and their team at Davis, where they were very interested in looking carefully at specific breeds over time and whether there was a relationship between early spay-neuter, especially early spay-neuter, but later spay-neuter as well, and subsequent health problems. And what they found is that lots of breeds like golden retrievers, you know, have increased rates of problems when they're a little bit older. Joint disease was the first thing they found, but then higher rates of cancers in a number of breeds.
And so they were
joint disease in lots of other breeds. Obesity is what you see in D6 dogs. So they're actually negative health effects to the individual dog.
Did the research could it demonstrate causality that the reason for these health concerns was directly attributable to the D-sexing?
as best as they could. I mean, so there are two ways to do that. So you're right. It's correlational, but it's compared with a group that is not D6, right? So which is intact. So that's reasonable assumption. But you're right. There could be other elements. The reason that it's thought to be contributory is because of what we know about the biology of removing the reproductive organs, mm-hmm. which is that you're removing the main source of these hormones that have various systemic effects. And some of those effects are to, for instance, protect the bodies against degradations that can lead to serious joint disease. If you remove this muscle-generating, bone-strengthening hormones from the body, mm-hmm. then you would expect to have joint and bone problems mm-hmm. later on. Mm-hmm. So that's very compelling and also and sort of argues for more of a case-by-case consideration yeah. of whether you're going to de-sex your animals or not, as opposed to just sort of a blanket policy that doesn't actually solve the problem.
Right. So, all right. So your article came out just a couple weeks ago, and you've had a couple that time for maybe the dust has settled. But I'm curious if this is such sacred ground. Have you had reactions? Have you had? Yeah. I would imagine. What have you heard so far?
Yeah, I had a lot of reaction. You know, some people react with great anger that I would talk about the policy at all. In fact, some people just read that I'm questioning spay neuter. I'm not looking or talking about spay neuter, and are angry just at that. Right. They're not interested in looking further.
Wait, I understand. They're angry that you raised the issue at all. Is that
yes? What yes, oh. That I raised the issue at all. Right. Because what do you have? A large community of people who, you know, want what we all want, which is not to have all these euthanized right. animals. Right. And this has been seen as the solution, so to talk about it is seen as problematic, even if it isn't the right solution, right? So that it's not being examined. I did hear from a lot of people who were really surprised, you know, because they don't know, they hadn't ever thought about it, so they appreciate at least the ability to think about the, you know, the issue, even if they might disagree with me. Mm-hmm. I heard from people who themselves had found another way to, you know, had their own concerns about it and found another way to deal with it. For instance, people who'd had their dogs have a vasectomy or tubal ligation. Mm-hmm. I heard from people who tried to create sterilants, you know, basically birth control, injectable birth control, and they've talked about the difficulties they've had in marketing those products because mm-hmm. There hasn't been a receptivity to an alternative to spay neuter. Yeah. So those were really interesting of responses.
Yeah, it's interesting because I hear those alternatives and they're all, you know, they're potentially viable, but it doesn't address what you were getting at, which is the convenience factor. You know, like you try to take your dog what do you call it, where they, if you're going on vacation and you take them to the doggy hotel.
Right, a border.
Boarding, right? They won't allow them in if they're not, quote unquote, fixed. And it's just, we do this, like you say, as a society, and this to our, really, I would say, we were talking about it on the show, the dogs really are number one. There's really no other companion animal that has this elevated status for us as a society, the dog does. And if we can do this for a convenience to dogs, I mean, think about how that bodes for the non-privileged animals, right?
Yeah, and I'm not saying that this is the worst slight one could do for a dog, right? There are worse things.
Yeah.
I am interested in the fact that societally we're kind of addressing our difficult way of living with dogs that we allow people to, and we kind of condone by considering them personal property, abandon animals or overbreed animals or mm-hmm. sell animals for profit. So that's the way we're set up to deal with dogs, that because of that, you know, we're going to be able to do things which are really not taking the dog's welfare into account. And right. if we're doing it with dogs, as you say, you know, they're kind of ambassadors for how we as a species might deal with other animals.
But right.
It would be nice to get it right with this species, right?
Right.
And look, then extend that outwards.
Outwards, right. So in other words, look to bring it back, sort of look beyond our convenience and get back to the umwelt, right? just kind of tie it all up.
Here.
Yeah. All right. Well,
to remember that there is a perspective out there besides
exactly.
our own.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks, Alexander. I appreciate your time. We have to take a break. And when we come back, we will we'll be talking with Shibano Sullivan. She's the founder of the IROAR Podcast Network, all the way from Australia. We'll be right back.
Your pets don't like getting in cages and cars to go to the vet any more than you like sitting in a waiting room. Why not remove the stress for both of you? Have All Pets House Calls with me, Dr. Tom Picard. Come take care of your pets from the comfort of their own couch. We do checkups and exams for illnesses, problems, shots, and much more. Monday through Saturday appointments throughout far and wide areas of Philadelphia and surrounding suburbs. Please call us at 215-843-1780, or please feel free to submit questions so I can answer them on the air for you. Contact us by email at allpetshousecalls@comcast.net or visit our website at allpetshousecallsvet.com.
All right, welcome back to The Other Animals on WWDB. Don't forget, later on this in the show, you have the opportunity to call our own vet, Dr. Tom Picard of All Pets House Call, 888-329-3306. Ask any pet questions you may have. All right, now, because of the time difference, this following segment I recorded. This is a conversation I had with Shibano Sullivan. And she is the, you'll hear the introduction, but she's the founder of the IROAR Podcast Network. She also shares my interest in our inconsistencies. And that is sort of as a hallmark to our relationship with the other animals. So we're going to be playing the first part of that conversation right now.
All right. My next guest is Shibano Sullivan. She's an academic based at the University of New South Wales in Sydney, Australia. She is also a fellow podcaster with her own podcast called Knowing Animals. And more recently, she helped establish the IROAR Podcasting Network, which The Other Animals is a proud charter member of. Shibano's interest is in animal protection and sharing academic ideas with the wider community. Welcome, Shibano.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
All right. Well, let me ask you, so before we get to the all your academics, I'm really curious, what was the genesis of the IROAR network? How did we get that off the ground?
Well, I, besides being a podcaster, I also listen to a lot of podcasts. And as you probably know, and your listeners probably know, a lot of them are part of a network. So they'll be affiliated with a network or another. And it's a nice way to pool resources. It's also a good way to allow your listeners to find other podcasts that are like-minded, that share the similar values. Mm-hmm. But there was nothing really for people who wanted to say something very positive about animals. And so I thought, why don't I just create it? I started talking to the wonderful people at Our Hen House, which some of your listeners might know that podcast. If they don't, they should check it out. And I said, why don't we start cross-promoting each other's podcast? And in the end, we thought it was a little bit difficult to just do that. So I thought, okay, think bigger. And there's a wonderful organization called the Cultural and Animals Foundation in the United States, and they make grants available. So I applied and was successful and went about setting up the network, and we're really, really thrilled to have you on board.
That's wonderful. How many podcasts do we have at the moment?
We've got 9 at the moment.
Oh, amazing.
So we've only been going for a couple of months. I really, really am hoping that more people will join. And also what I'm hoping is that as more people establish podcasts, so create them, podcasts that don't exist today, but maybe someone's starting another relevant one next week, they'll think about us and join the network. It's free to join. So it's really, it's just a service to make listeners aware of a whole suite of podcasts that are really like-minded and speak with a singular value.
Yeah, and I see it as, for myself, as immensely valuable, because we all, when we start these, either our shows or our podcasts, we have a certain theme, you know, a certain format that we're shooting for, but there's so many different ways to come at it, right?
Yeah.
And like, for example, I know you have a podcast. What's the basis of your podcast?
So my podcast is, it's got two kind of themes that run through it, so two types of shows. One of them, the main one, is called Knowing Animals, and I interview an animal studies scholar, so someone who's an academic that's writing in a way that's very kind of strongly pro-animal from a whole range of different disciplines, and we talk about one particular piece of their work, whether it be their book or a journal article they've written or something else. I also interview artists, so it could be an exhibition they've done. And then we chat for about 15, 20 minutes just about that particular work, and they explain what inspired it, why they did it, etc. And then I end all my episodes with what I call the five quick questions. So I ask all the guests the same five questions.
Cool. So give me a pointer. What are they? I'm going to steal your idea.
Yes. So the first question is, can you remember the first piece of pro animal scholarship you ever read? So really the first thing, you know, that came to your radar. A lot of people do say Peter Singer's Animal Liberation, I have to say.
Oh, sure.
Very popular response. And then I say, can you remember the first thing you wrote? So I'm trying to understand, you know, whether they've been doing this for a long time. You know, some people, the piece we're discussing that day is the first thing they've wrote. And then I say, ask them whether what's something positive that academics can do for animals. And so then they, you know, some people talk about research, some people talk about teaching, you know, I get a range of different responses. I ask them if they had to name one academic who's had a big impact on them, who would it be? So perhaps it's not the first person they read, but it might be, you know, someone who really has influenced them. And there's one more question in there. I can't quite bring it to mind at the moment. Listeners will have to go to the podcast.
There you go. Keep waiting. Right? All right. So that's yours. So yours has, I would fair to say, it sounds like an academic basis, right? Which is you know, one approach. I know for mine, I also tend to have authors and publishers, authors and, you know, writers, and I try to. I would say some of my more interesting shows where I've been able to get people who have written and then a subsequent guest who may have actually had real world experience in something that the first guest has written about. Those tend to be really, I love doing those shows. What are some of the other, some of our sister podcasters? I know you mentioned the our Hen House.
Yeah.
What's that one about? And you can just talk about some of our other brothers and sisters in the network.
Yeah. So Our Hen House, it comes out of kind of a mix of New York and LA, and these are really strong animal advocates. And what they do is, Our Hen House is a bit of a mixed one, so they talk about a lot of different issues, really interviewing activists, animal advocates, what's going on in the animal activist scene. But they also have another law-based podcasts that they do, and they've got another cooking-based podcast. So that same team, the little Our Hen House team, are quite the powerhouse. Now we also have another legal podcast coming out of Canada, which is very cutely called Paw and Order. And then we've got Freedom of Species, which is an Australian podcast, and it comes out of Melbourne, and they again interview a lot of animal advocates and just see what the issues are, what's going on, you know, in Australia and around the world. We've also got, of course, your podcast. We've got Go Vegan Radio. We've got Main Street Vegan. So you're probably detecting a theme there.
Sure. But that's, yeah. That's what we want. We're getting this variety, right? We're getting a real nice, right? You go from yours, which is heavily, a strong emphasis on the academic, sort of through mine, and then the others, which are just, it sounds to me, are just advocacy, right? And how to adapt a vegan lifestyle. I'm guessing there's probably things in there with recipes and food choices and that kind of an approach.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think, look, the Teaching Jasmine How to Cook Vegan podcast, I think, is very, very culinarily based, whereas others I think are a bit of a mix. And of course, for many people, veganism incorporates a range of different things. Cooking, but also, you know, lifestyle choices, etc.
Yeah. All right. So one of the things that's really intriguing with the network is just listening. So obviously we have heard two shows at the moment out of Australia. One or two shows that turn out of Canada, a couple shows out of the States. And I think that's what that opens the door as we begin to get this global or international perspective the network can provide for people. Well, you know, for example, in my show, obviously I'm very states oriented. I'm going to the United States, so I've even talked about individual states' laws, you know, and how they vary from state to state, and federal legislation. I had a very prominent congressman on a couple weeks ago, but it's all, of course, United States based. And I think the network gives the opportunity to look at some of how different, not just countries, but cultures may be dealing with their with animal questions as they come up. So, you know, I think laws, while we want them to be similar, are probably very different when we span the globe. I'm curious, when I introduced on my show a few weeks ago that I was part of the network, I was projecting that we might possibly expand beyond English podcasts. Is there anything like that in the works that you know?
Oh, look, I would absolutely love that. And, you know, if anyone is listening and either has a relevant podcast or is starting one up, please think about contacting me. I can see through my own podcast kind of hosting site that I do have listeners all around the world, including in a lot of non-English speaking countries. That said, of course, America is such a big country that now most of my listeners are actually in America. Really? So it's kind of interesting, you know, that just the volume of people means that America is the most prominent listener of even a modest little Australian-based podcast such as my own. But when I look at the profile of my guests as well, and every now and then I'll go and just make sure I'm doing a good job in terms of gender balance and that kind of thing, what I see is I'm not getting enough guests on, or as many guests on as I'd like, from Asia. So, of course, there's so much happening in Asia. I've recorded a few episodes in Thailand, but I'd love to have more Asian voices on the podcast and also more Indigenous voices. So, I had one great interview with a very, very lovely researcher who was looking at Indigenous issues in Canada. But I really need also to get more Indigenous voices. So there are so many ways in which we can still expand both my podcast and also the network. So I have to say, when I look at this podcasting network, you know, it was an idea 6 months ago and it was nothing kind of 2 months ago. So it's a modest start, but in some ways I think, wow, we've kind of come a long way in a short period of time, and who knows, maybe one day we will have podcasts all around the world.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. I'd love to see us like more of what we're doing right now. So we podcasters talk to each other and see, you know, really get a pulse of when we encounter some kind of a situation. This is how we're doing it in America. How are you handling it? You know, in Australia, how are you handling it in Canada? You know, I think that'd be really valuable. So I want to switch gears for just a second. So we sort of skipped over, we talked about how you got the podcast, the IROR Podcast Network going. But your own background, of course, is academic. And I really enjoy your book, which is Animals, Equality, and Democracy. Yeah. It was part of a series, right, which was edited by Andrew Lindsay, who's I'm studied in my own academic work. And I just wanted to ask you, because it's very interesting, and it's sort of a premise to my podcast, is you talk a lot about the nature of inconsistencies. And I've mentioned several times on my show that inconsistencies are part of what we are, and the old adage that perfection is the enemy of good, or the different variants on that, that people so often try to do all or nothing that they miss, you know, they miss the forest through the trees. For, you know, that there is a benefit, even though we are inconsistent, I say own our inconsistencies. So you have two different types of inconsistencies that you talk about, internal and external, in when it comes to our relationship with non-human animals. I just wonder if you could spend a few minutes and tell us about that.
Yeah. So it's a very interesting question, and I think my approach to it is quite different to what you were just saying. But I guess what I would like to first of all premise my response with is to say that I do agree with you. And, you know, I've been on a bit of a journey with my own veganism, you know, over the past 20 plus years. And I was someone who was an extremely strict vegan, and my attitude was, you know, you're vegan or you're for us or against us, or for the animals or against the animals. But my attitude softened over the years, and I think quite a few people have as well. And I think that it's not so black and white. And, you know, also quite frankly, at times I wonder whether all the times I've, grumpily sat there not eating anything has really helped make the world a better place for animals when we look at, what's happening in terms of animal production, et cetera. So I do think that there is scope to be a little bit kinder to ourselves and to others when it comes to, you know, who we are. But with my book, what I did with that, and it started off as my PhD thesis and then became my book, what I wanted to say was, I'm a political scientist, and I wanted to think about how we might think about animals politically and how they might be incorporated into our political system. And the kind of political system we have in Australia, also the same in the United States, Canada, England, elsewhere, is broadly described as a liberal democracy. And there are certain values that are said to be important in a liberal democracy, and one of them is equitable treatment. So we can't just arbitrarily decide things. There's no law that we create that applies only to, you know, a white person, not a person of colour, a man, not a woman, etc. To do that is to be inconsistent, and to be inconsistent is to be inequitable, and that is said to be problematic from the kind of values that are supposed to be incorporated in liberal democracy. And so what I say in my book is, look, if we are, you know, if we really want to be true to the values that we say we are true to, then we have to think about what equity means when it comes to animals and the way we incorporate animals into our political system. And one of the ways we do that is via creating laws. Mm-hmm. So what I point out is that we have these very, very arbitrary laws. You know, in my book, I show that the laws, you know, even simple things such as this is in the state of New South Wales, so we've got a federal system in Australia. So the state of New South Wales in Australia, when an animal is being exhibited in a zoo and the community can see the animal's cage has to be a particular size. And then when the animal's off exhibit, so behind the scenes, the size of this cage suddenly can lawfully be much smaller. And, for example, in a pet store, if a kitten is sick and needs to be euthanized, a vet must be called. If a rabbit's sick and needs to be euthanized, the pet store owner can just kill the rabbit. And so I say, what is the basis of these inconsistencies? They seem to be arbitrary. They don't seem to be consistent with the values we say we hold. And so what I propose is that we decide that we're going to take consistency and equitable treatment seriously and apply it to the lives of animals. And what I argue in the book is that, you know, so some of my critics say, well, that will result in a race to the bottom. And you know, whenever you try to propose something that might make the world a better place, you always come up against this argument of a race to the bottom. But what I say is, well, at least then we'd have visibility. So if I could take my dog to the local park and treat my dog lawfully the same way a dog could be treated in a research laboratory, or if I could keep hens in my, say, front yard where people can see them and have them confined in the same way that they are in the egg-growing industry, well, then the community would at least see and they could have a legitimate view on that. Because the other thing that we say we value in a liberal democracy is political participation, transparency, and the community's ability to engage in lawmaking. And the situation we have at the moment, both in Australia and the United States, is that a lot of animals are suffering in very serious ways, but we can't see that suffering because it's all happening in these
behind the scenes.
All right, and that was my part one of my conversation with Shibano Sullivan. We may get to the second part at a later episode. When we return, it'll be your turn to talk to Dr. Tom Picard of All Pets House Calls. Give us a shout, 888-329-3306. We'll be right back.
Your pets don't like getting in cages and cars to go to the vet any more than you like sitting in a waiting room. Why not remove the stress for both of you? Have All Pets House Calls with me, Dr. Tom Picard, come take care of your pets from the comfort of their own couch. We do checkups and exams for illnesses, problems, shots, and much more. Monday through Saturday appointments throughout far and wide areas of Philadelphia and surrounding suburbs. Please call us at 215-843-1780, or please feel free to submit questions so I can answer them on the air for you. Contact us by email at allpetshousecalls@comcast.net or visit our website at allpetshousecallsvet.com.
We think our vet is very helpful. We think our vet is smart and nice. Our vet takes such good care of us, but would rather stay home. Rather be home to catch mice.
And we're back on The Other Animals, WWB. It's our time now to talk with Dr. Tom Picard of All Pets House Called. And excuse me, I think I have this feeling, and I could be wrong, Tom, but I'm thinking of those old 70s or 80s cable TV things. And now, for an opposing point of view, do I take it right that you might have had some exception to what Dr. Horowitz was saying?
Well,
nice.
look, it is always valuable to gain more data. And, you know, I think, you know, studies or, you know, historical analysis of previous information is great because sometimes we can find out things. And, you know, if there really is a correlation between, you know, female dogs, spayed versus unspayed, and feature health things like their hips and things like that. I mean, that is important stuff to learn. Mm-hmm. But there are things that we do know that are not speculation at this point. As far as females go, and throw all the spay-neuter thing for population control and things like that out the window at the moment.
Okay.
It'd be great if everybody was responsible for pets and this wasn't a problem. But
okay.
Just disregard that at the moment.
All right, so put that aside for a moment.
And disregard some of the convenience things for human beings living with animals. You know, for females, certainly, you know, a monthly, you know, mess in your house based on their estrus period is not always desirable, and they're not exactly like humans where you can, you know, easily, sanitarily, you know, wrap them up.
Right.
Male dogs, convenience things. Not wanting them to have the desire to roam and fight and procreate and hump your leg and your guest legs and things like that. Those are convenience things. But medical reasons. Females, we know that any female, the more heat cycles they go through, the less advantage they have later in life at a lower risk of mammary cancer.
Really?
We know this.
Okay.
We know that if they go through multiple heat cycles, they've lost that benefit. If we get them before their first heat, they have that benefit. It's not enormous.
Wait, I'm confused. If you're saying if you spay them before their first one, it's better? They gain the
right.
Okay.
The average heat for a female is 10 months. So that's why we do them at about 6 months. Also, it's safer for their anesthesia recovery. There are shelters who do these animals so young, it's crazy, but they lived. So,
okay.
But it's for anesthesia safety reasons that we do them at 6 months. That's also you're getting them before their first heat. And we know that unspayed females might never have a problem their whole life. But there are many, we know the correlation to being not spayed, mammary cancer, ovarian cancer, uterine cancer, pyometra, which is an infection of the uterus, which is a potential monthly problem. You know, uh-huh. Your dog could have this at any point. You know, for dogs go into heat twice a year, every 6 months. And that time, they are even at greater risk for a pyometra, which has killed many a female dog. And or cost thousands of dollars.
Amazing.
To spay that dog. It's an emergency.
You know, so
and I'm guessing it's painful too, right? It must be very painful for the dog.
Well, that's certainly a much more risky situation if they have a pyometra, and that's definitely a worse recovery and more painful for sure.
Okay.
Male dogs, we know they are much more prone to types of cancers around their rectal tissue, these perianal adenocarcinomas. One of the cures for that cancer is to neuter them. That actually makes most of those tumors go away. So we know it's a direct correlation. Certainly prostate cancers and problems, enlargements as male dogs, testicular cancers and things. So it's not just for our convenience. There really are medical reasons for doing this. But yes, hey, humans are irresponsible. And there's a lot of animals, dogs and cats out there that suffer their whole lives because they have no home. They roam the streets. Any amount of that we can reduce is a positive thing, because we can't control humans enough to make them stop being so stupid.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I was going to ask her about that, actually. That there, you know, the article, her article has this concept of, I actually have it out here, that what we can do, our actions as species, those are actually her words, and unfortunately she's not with us at the moment anyway, but controlling, you know, emphasizing our actions as species, and that's struck me as such a broad, we can't do that. You know, it's like exactly what you were just saying is that, you know, you try and get to one at a time. We can just change one person at a time. But in the meantime, I hear what you're saying. I hear what you're saying is that there is the individual dog or cat that we are, for better or for worse, responsible for. And that's kind of what you're saying, that we have this dog or cat, and at least for this one or two dogs that we have responsibility for, we could at least, you're saying there is a definite incontrovertible medical benefit to having this procedure done, regardless of what it does, what the secondary or tertiary benefit would be for population control, right?
There's not a female dog, cat, or male dog or cat that would be my personal pet. If I'm not going to breed them, they're going to be spayed and neutered, because I know the health benefits of this, you know. And, you know, are there other things that affects? Well, you know, there is. It's not a complete absence of the hormones in the body after these things are removed.
I was wondering about that, because, you can still produce. Explain that to me, because I thought I was confused by that. Actually, go ahead.
There are still some of these, the cells in some areas that will continue, minute things. Minute amounts of these hormones. The vast majority are in the testes and the ovaries. But also, that reminds me of one thing. People always talk about, oh, my dog got overweight when they got spayed or neutered. Testosterone and the estrogen and progesterone are responsible for at most 5% of body metabolism.
Really?
So you're not losing much. You know, any reason they get heavy is because they're just not active enough,
yeah,
and they're not eating right.
Right.
That 5% isn't much. You can't it's hang your hat on 5%.
All right. Hey, thanks, Tom. We're out of time. That was really – I appreciate that. I regret we couldn't maybe have both sides on at the same time, but I think that sheds a nice country light. So that's it for this week. I want to thank our guest, Alexandra Horowitz. Don't forget, you can see her at this week. Shibano Sullivan, thanks to Jason Duffy, our engineer. Also want to hear from you. If you've got ideas or comments or interested in advertising on the other animals, please go to theotheranimals.com. Don't forget to check out our partner podcasts at iroarpod.com. Next week, we have a really cool show, dinosaurs, dragons, and mythical beasts. So we're talking about animals that don't even exist and how we relate to them. Have a fascinating conversation with author Boria Sachs. We will see you then.